Good afternoon. We've made it to Friday and almost to the end of February. This is Ozarks at Large for February 26th, 21 on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead today, a stand-your-ground bill is approved by both chambers of the Arkansas legislature and only requires the governor's signature to become law. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports. And Michael Tilley, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, guides us through a counterintuitive maze of local sales tax numbers. They're up during the pandemic, but might drop when the pandemic is over. Our conversation about that and more begins in about 12 minutes. Today on Science Friday, after Ozarks, a conversation with the newly appointed Senior Climate Advisor to NASA, Gavin Schmidt, about satellites, weather, and decision-making, plus a look at what went wrong in the Texas electric grids during last week's storm. Science Friday, today from 1 to 3, right after Ozarks at Large. There are 726 new cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas after the most recent day of testing. The Arkansas Department of Health also notes 10 additional deaths from the virus. For the first time this week, the number of active cases rose by 44. There are now more than 4,700 active cases. Hospitalizations also increased in the last 24 hours by 26. The Oklahoma State Department of Health is adding 38 deaths to that state's total fatalities from coronavirus. The deaths added yesterday stretch back to the first of the year. Last night, the Benton County Quorum Court voted against a resolution supporting lifting COVID-19 restrictions on businesses. The resolution, which was sponsored by Justice of the Peace Kerry Smith, failed 8-6. The Quorum Court, made up of 14 Republicans with one seat vacant. The resolution called on Governor Asa Hutchinson to lift all restrictions on privately owned businesses. This morning, Governor Hutchinson announced that many of the state's directives are effective immediately, becoming guidelines, including those for restaurants, gyms, salons, and indoor and outdoor venues. A guidance based on scientific data is a strong recommendation based on medical advice. The governor extended the state's public health emergency to the end of March. That emergency was scheduled to expire at midnight tomorrow night. We'll have more from the governor's announcement later this hour. The University of Arkansas reports more than 3,500 employees will have received at least the first dose of vaccine for COVID-19 by early next week. University officials say at least 1,500 employees have received both doses of the vaccine. Residents of Oklahoma affected by this month's winter storms can apply for federal disaster assistance. Oklahomans in 16 counties, mostly in eastern Oklahoma, can apply at disasterassistance.gov or by calling 800-621-3362. When applying for assistance, it's advised to have a list of damages incurred, insurance policy numbers if insured, plus personal information including home address and social security number. Clouds tonight, lows in the upper 30s to 42. Tomorrow, 50% chance of rain in northwest Arkansas, 70% chance in the Arkansas River Valley. Highs tomorrow in the lower 60s. And Sunday's forecast includes a 50% chance of rain with highs from 52 to 57. This is Ozarks at Large. The winter weather postponed Arkansas legislative sessions last week, and that complicated things for a time-sensitive bill aimed at expanding eligibility for certain Arkansas scholarships, including the governor's Distinguished Scholarship, to students with legal status. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
The deadline to apply for the scholarship is March 1st, so Senator Bart Hester has rushed to push Senate Bill 287 through the legislature this week. He originally intended to run the bill last week, but due to inclement weather, had to wait until this Monday to present it to the Senate Education Committee. With the new timetable, he said next Monday would now be the earliest the bill could make it through the legislature and to the governor's desk.
The governor has agreed to sign it, I believe, still Monday, and then the department will have some they have some ability for some discretion, whether they'll allow those kids until midnight or until maybe one more day or something to get their stuff. The department hasn't said exactly, but they have some discretion for these students. But the important is to stay on step to get it to the governor's desk Monday, which is the last day to apply.
SB 287 amends the scholarship requirements to expand eligibility beyond United States citizens and permanent residents. Senator Hester, a Republican from Cave Springs, presented the bill on the Senate floor Tuesday.
What this does is if you are lawfully present in Arkansas, you have legal status, that you are eligible to receive that scholarship. So this would include students that are like an H-4, so if your parents are here on a work visa, then you would be eligible. If you're a DACA student, anybody that's legally here, has gone to school here. There's some girls in my district that have gone to Bentonville schools from kindergarten through 12th grade that qualify, and they've worked hard and earned this scholarship, and I sure hope we see it fit to allow them to receive it.
If passed, the legislation would also open up the scholarship to Marshallese students legally residing in the state under a Compact of Free Association. SB 287 does not alter the academic requirements for the scholarship. According to the Arkansas Department of Higher Education, the minimum eligibility criteria to be named a Governor's Distinguished Scholar are either a 32 on the ACT or 1410 combined math and critical reasoning score on the SAT, and either a 3.5 grade point average or selection as a National Achievement Finalist or National Merit Finalist. A student's financial need is not a factor in the award of the scholarship, which will pay up to $10,000 per year for tuition, mandatory fees, room, and board. The bill passed the Senate Wednesday by a vote of 33-1, with one senator voting present. Representative Clint Penzo, a Republican from Springdale, ran the bill in the House Education Committee yesterday morning.
Department of Education estimates two students will be affected in this cycle. The deadline for these scholarships is March 1st. That's why they were trying to rush it through the Senate, get it over to us so we can actually have it to the governor's desk and sign Monday if it obviously passes the House. So we're kind of in a rush to get this through. These students have worked hard to meet the requirements, and I believe they deserve these scholarships.
One of those qualifying students is Ananya Van Gore, a senior at Bentonville West High School in Centerton. She has been attending Arkansas schools since kindergarten and says she wants to continue her higher education at the University of Arkansas.
I have worked hard to earn a 34 on my ACT, qualifying me for the governor's scholarship. That score was a result of numerous hours doing practice tests, learning different concepts, as well as the use of a few Saturdays to take the actual test. I am a student dedicated to my studies, and I believe that I have earned the governor's scholarship by all academic measures. And with the support of the committee, I would have the opportunity to apply for and receive the scholarship just like my fellow peers.
The House Education Committee unanimously approved the bill, which is now headed to the House floor. The Arkansas House is not in session today, so SB 287 is expected to be presented to the full Arkansas House Monday. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Joining me now on the phone from his office in Fort Smith is Michael Tilley with Talk Business and Politics. Michael, happy Friday.
Well, happy Friday to you. And before we get into our comments, I just want to say publicly and encourage your listeners who don't check in, to encourage them to check into your conversations with the folks at the Pryor Center in history and to listen to all of that audio and different aspects of Arkansas history that is being digitized and preserved at the Pryor Center there at the university. It's great, great pieces of Arkansas history that you're bringing back to life.
Well, thank you. I'll pass that along to Randy Dixon, who gets all those archives ready for us. And I don't think you meant to do this, but it's a nice little segue that I can tell people. Wednesday night, Randy and I will be live on your computer,
right?
A Pryor Center thing, and we'll show you some of our favorite archives. You won't just hear them, you'll show them. You can go to pryorcenter.uark.edu to sign up for free to watch us. So thank you for that. Well, let's talk about, you know, there was a time, Michael Tilley, when you and I in our conversations, it seems like every few weeks we would talk about some jobs leaving Fort Smith. We're now kind of in a nice little consecutive streak of talking about jobs being created in Fort Smith, and last week was no different.
Fort Smith Regional Chamber, you know, they could almost take off the rest of the year and still have had a successful year. But Owens Corning recently announced, and this is the third significant announcement in less than 60 days, less than 2 months, that they're going to build a new 550,000 square foot manufacturing plant in Fort Smith. It's about a $115 million project. The company has a plant now in the city. It employs about 80 folks, and that plant will close once this new plant opens. Now, the company, Owens Corning, makes a lot of building products. This company makes a lot of what are called composite materials. They produce the mat, kind of some of the materials that are used in roofing shingles, some other what are called non-woven products, products that are inserted into other building materials. And you know, Owens Corning, this is a pretty large company. They operate in about 33 countries, have almost 20,000 people employed. And now the issue, a point I want to make with this announcement, it's going to add, their estimate is it'll add 5 jobs, boosting employment up to around 85. Now, seen some online comments, people are saying, gosh, I can't believe the state and the city are ponying up all these incentives just for 5 jobs. But in the world of economic development, and fortunately I had a taste of it, I spent 6 years, I was employed at the Fort Smith Chamber working in economic development for 6 years. So the thing you have to remember, it's not just 5 jobs. Owens Corning has locations, like I said, all over the world. They could have picked any other site for this plant, and if they would have picked another site, you would have lost the 80 jobs that are here now. So you can kind of be a negative Nelly and look at it that they're just adding 5 jobs, or you can say, hey, they're staying in Fort Smith, they're going to enhance their investment, enhance the value of the property tax over time, and add 5 jobs. So I think it's a win for the, obviously for the chamber, but a win for the city. And remember, the other announcements is Hytrol, which is based in Jonesboro, announced plans to open a manufacturing plant in Fort Smith. They announced that January 4th. That'll add about 250 jobs within 5 years. Then Mars Pet Care, which is already here, announced January 15th, $145 million expansion that'll add 120 jobs. So 3 good hits right out of the gate for a new year for Fort Smith, and especially for the beleaguered manufacturing sector.
Speaking of announcements, the city of Fort Smith is one of 5 waiting for an announcement about where a pilot training center for the military's foreign military sales program is going to be located. One of 5 finalists, but now it's going to be a while before we find out where it's going.
Right. It's not a surprise. It was back in July of last year that the Air Force announced that they're going to try to consolidate this pilot training center, which is now somewhat happening at Luke Air Force Base near Phoenix. The bottom line is that when the U.S. sells these advanced fighter airplanes to some of our allies, and specifically in this case, it's Singapore, training comes along with that, and you want to train them in the U.S., especially for small countries like Singapore that may not have a lot of airspace in which to train. With that, the Air Force finally said, look, we're just going to create one place where the Air Force can not only keep some of the existing planes in the Singapore example, their F-16s, but where we can put the F-35, the new fighter planes that they're purchasing in with which we're training them. It would be a pretty large, it would bring a lot of jobs, bring a lot of folks to wherever that is selected. As you said, the 188 facility there at Ebbing Air National Guard Base in Fort Smith is one of the 5. They think they have an advantage because they've got a couple of what are called military operation areas nearby, which is Razorback Ridge, also what's called the Hog MOA, military operation area, and the Shirley MOA, which is a large operating area, which is in north central part of the state. That the decision on that has been delayed because of the presidential transition. Initially, we thought we might get an announcement in late 2020 or early 2021. But that's kind of gone. I think the most definitive estimate, which I'm not sure that's a real term, but is from Colonel Gentry, Colonel Jeremiah Gentry, 188th Wing Vice Commander, who said it could be spring 2021 before we get a decision. My only concern, just from a political aspect, you know, we have the new president is a Democrat, and politics, like or not, sometimes plays into these decisions. And you know, U.S. Senator Tom Cotton, and I don't care what your politics are. This is not a comment on politics. He has not been especially kind to some of the cabinet picks and some of the policies of incoming President Biden. I don't know if that'll have an impact or not, but he has certainly been a very outspoken critic of President Biden, and so let's hope that doesn't count against Arkansas in this decision.
Well, speaking of counting, if you're counting the sales tax revenue for the city of Fort Smith, this still seems so counterintuitive to me. The sales tax numbers continue to improve when you compare year to year. That's the case for the January report. Michael, what's going on?
Yeah, well, and I think, I've been trying to read more about this, looking at what some economists saying, and it is counterintuitive, as you noted, but I think what we're seeing is, you know, the first couple of months after, you know, which we're almost coming up on a year since we've been shut down, the first couple of months, you know, the sales tax collections in almost any city, county, state around the country were depressed because people, you know, when we were in that shutdown in March, April, and May, nothing really was happening, I guess, unless people were buying toilet paper, if you remember.
Right.
But then people, you know, began to buy again. We've seen a lot of online sales. And what we have seen and what economists tell us we're seeing, and apparently has some accuracy based on the numbers, is that people are spending more on goods that are tied to tax revenue for cities and counties and states. So instead of Michael Tilley and Kyle Kellum's, you know, traveling and spending money, you know, on services or out of state things that we might normally do outside of a pandemic, we're spending more of our money on groceries and other goods that are taxed. So while the economy is struggling, while, you know, we look at our GDP and we look at our employment and those things are struggling, that spending that would normally have shifted somewhere else, we've shifted back to these tax revenue sources. So I think that's why we're seeing gains. The city share of Sebastian County tax is $1.8 million, almost $1.9 million. That was up over 11% compared to January 2020. And if you remember, January and February of 2020 were pretty robust months because the economy was doing well before the pandemic hit. So, and we're seeing this all over. We see record tax revenue collections in Northwest Arkansas cities in recent months. So it's just a shift of spending. Also, some economists will tell you that federal stimulus, in which people receive direct checks or in which they received enhanced unemployment benefits, not only provided people with more money, but provided them a little bit more confidence to spend. So some of that has had an effect. But I think once, you know, we're being told by the end of summer or fall, at least by Christmas, when things return to normal, when things return to normal and people can begin traveling and doing,
interesting.
And when I say return to normal, I mean some semblance of normal,
right,
that these tax, don't be surprised if these tax revenues begin to decline because people are not, you know, you may still be spending $100 a week, but instead of $90 a week going to tax revenue sources for cities and counties, only $70 a week is going to that. So that's why I'm very interested as just a reporter geek who's covered this kind of thing for decades now. It's going to be interesting to see how that shifts as more people are vaccinated and the economy opens up.
All right, Michael Tilley and Talk Business and Politics cover all of this and so much more. You can go to talkbusiness.net every day to see what they've got in their latest editions. Michael, thank you so much for your time, and we'll talk to you next Friday when it will be the month of March.
Okay. Oh, gosh. Yeah, bring it on. Let's get further into the year. Gosh, let's go.
Right. Thanks, Michael.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
After previous legislative attempts, Arkansas lawmakers this week approved a stand-your-ground gun measure allowing for the use of deadly force in self-defense. The bill now awaits the signature of Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Stand-your-ground laws enacted across several dozen U.S. states allows the use of deadly force against a person intending to murder, cause extreme bodily harm, kidnap, or rape another person. Arkansas lawmakers approved such a law this week, including removing an obligation under a current state self-defense law to retreat from a threat. Senate Bill 24 was filed 2 days before Christmas by State Senator Bob Ballinger, a Republican from Ozark. Here's Ballinger laying out a rationale to replace existing self-defense codes in Arkansas with his law during an interview last month with their content partner, Talk Business and Politics.
The problem is the code itself. So the problem is the law that is ambiguous, that is not being carried out in practice. And if it were being carried out in practice, it would put an onerous restriction on citizens that's ambiguous and not good. That's not the best policy. It's not the best policy to require the victim to have to run away if they think they can run away. The best policy is for the victim to be able to stand and defend themselves.
The bill originally filed by Ballinger 2 years ago failed to gain enough support. It also ran into some obstacles this session, including opposition by Arkansas civil and disability rights advocates, as well as gun control groups. They've long lobbied to block Stand Your Ground, as well as concealed and open carry of guns.
Well, obviously, we're disappointed that some of our lawmakers ignored their constituents, and that includes gun owners and faith leaders and advocates alike.
Amy Gillespie is with Moms Demand Action, a grassroots movement working to enact stronger gun laws to prevent gun violence and to encourage a culture of responsible gun ownership. Moms Demand Action, with volunteer chapters in all 50 states, is affiliated with Everytown for Gun Safety, the largest gun violence prevention organization in the country, from which Gillespie cites consequences of Stand Your Ground laws.
Research shows that Stand Your Ground laws are associated with an increase in homicide rates that translates to more than 150 additional gun deaths each month in the U.S. overall. And research has also determined that such laws are associated with an increase in emergency room visits and hospitalizations. And of course, this is all at a time when our hospitals here in Arkansas, they're already stretched thin with coronavirus.
According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which tracks the consequences of enabling gun laws, gun violence tends to increase after states enact Stand Your Ground laws, particularly impacting African Americans. And Gillespie says Arkansans currently have the right to protect themselves.
If an intruder breaks into your home or property, or they call it curtilage, you have the right to defend yourself under Castle Doctrine. And that is to defend yourself up to and including deadly force. If someone attacks you on the street or somewhere in a public place, you have the right to defend yourself up to and including deadly force, unless you can get away in complete safety.
The Castle Doctrine, also known as Castle Law or Defense of Habitat Law, are state legal defense laws that give citizens in their homes, cars, or workplaces the right to protect themselves, other people, and their property by force. A Castle Doctrine also states that a person has no duty of retreat, avoiding the conflict at all cost when one's home is under attack. Technically, Arkansas has no Castle Law on the books, but use of lethal force is justified in certain situations under certain state codes. But SB 24, which is sweeping on Thursday, was sent to Governor Asa Hutchinson for approval, a decision expected early next week. Gillespie says they're concentrating their efforts on swaying Hutchinson to their side.
Well, we're reaching out to the governor in various ways. Our constituents can text the word Arkansas to 64433, and that will connect you to the governor's office where you can leave him a message. I believe there's also an online petition that sends him an email.
In 2017, Arkansas lawmakers approved expanded carry of concealed weapons in Arkansas in certain public facilities and churches. And later that year, Governor Asa Hutchinson issued a letter to Arkansas State Police clarifying that under state law, a person may open carry a handgun so long as there is no intent to unlawfully employ the handgun. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Thanks to everybody who joined us last night for a town hall connected to our podcast, The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas. Last night's town hall was hosted by the Fayetteville Public Library. If you missed it, the session will be archived for later viewing on the library's YouTube page. You can learn much more at faylib.org. And we'll share excerpts on editions of Ozarks at Large throughout March. Our guests last night included Sherry Dupree and Lisa Hicks Gilbert, two women working to make sure massacres of Black Americans in Florida and Arkansas in the first part of the 20th century are not forgotten, and the devastating effects those massacres had on generations of Americans are not forgotten either. Look for more about the conversation at faylib.org. And Wednesday, we invite you to join us for another live virtual public event on March 3rd. That's Wednesday night. Join Randy Dixon and myself for a virtual trip through Arkansas history. Randy is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. And every Monday, he joins me on this show with archives from the center for an audio trip through time. Wednesday night, we're going to add video to some of our favorite archives we've discussed over the past year, from the Titan missile explosion to Johnny Cash's nearly forgotten Fayetteville concert in the 1980s. You can register to join us by Zoom for free by going to pryorcenter.uark.edu. Join us for Arkansas News History, exploring the KATV collection Wednesday night, live beginning at 6. There will be a chance for you to ask questions as well. Again, you can register for free at pryorcenter.uark.edu. And on Monday's Ozarks at Large, Randy Dixon will be back with us on the radio. He's bringing archives relating to the integration of Little Rock Central. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson hosted an additional coronavirus response briefing this morning to make three announcements. The first is that he's extending the public health emergency declaration for another 30 days to March 31st. The continuation of the declaration, the governor says, allows for continued Medicaid reimbursements for telehealth, business liability protections, and remote learning options for school districts. But because of the progress the state has made in reducing cases and increasing vaccinations, the governor also announced the mask mandate, which was put into place back in July, will also end on March 31st if certain goals are met before that time.
If we can achieve a positivity rate of 10% or less, both PCR and antigen positivity rate, with at least 7,500 testing specimens on average daily, then March 31st, we can move away from the mask mandate and it would become simply a guideline. And then the other, you might say, well, we might not be testing at that level. And so the second point is that if testing is below 7,500 on an average, then we'll look at the number of hospitalized patients based upon COVID. And if that's fewer than 750 hospitalized statewide for COVID-19, then we can use that as a trigger as well.
The governor also announced that effective immediately, all other public health directives that have been issued by the state and carried certain penalties will be converted to public health guidelines.
The examples of where this would make a difference would be in restaurants, gyms, salons, indoor venues, and outdoor venues will be subject to the same guidance that we've had in the form of directives, but it will be guidance. The reasons for this, as I've stated, we've made progress in the pandemic. Businesses have adjusted and made changes to their business model in the interest of public health, and we've seen a steady decline in cases. Also, we've had increased public education, so the public knows exactly what is needed to stop the spread of the virus. They know where they can go safely, where they can't go safely, and they can make those judgments.
The governor says his announcements today are a way of providing a pathway for people to get back to normal life. But he adds that they don't mean there should be a change in behaviors like mask wearing and social distancing.
In terms of our businesses, they are incentivized to follow the guidelines because that gives them business liability protection. Because the business liability protection is based upon following public health guidelines and making a good faith effort to make sure everyone is safe in their employment. So they are incentivized, and so it does not mean a change in behavior that you will see. It does allow for some flexibility in indoor venue events, outdoors. There's more flexibility if the guideline doesn't make sense.
The governor says the change from directives to guidelines doesn't eliminate the necessity of quarantining because those mandates are part of his public health emergency declaration.
If the cases go up, I would remind everybody that the emergency order remains in place, and so we can adjust as needed. The mask mandate remains in place through March 31st. So we have an opportunity to continue to watch where the cases go over that period of time. And then if we see a dramatic change or necessity based upon where we are with the virus, then the guidelines can be reinstated as mandates.
As far as what the governor's announcements mean for school districts, he says policies on mask wearing and social distancing remain in the hands of local school boards, most of which adopted those measures before the start of the school year.
The guidance on capacity and social distancing will allow for proms, athletic events, graduation, other extracurricular activities to be held. Quarantine guidance will not change, and the identification of close contacts will stay in place. I know there'll be a lot of questions on the education side that they'll be working with both the Department of Health and the Department of Education to answer any questions that might come up.
Arkansas's Secretary of Health, Dr. Jose Romero, says the state continues to have a robust system in place to monitor any rise in cases or rise in hospitalizations. But he says COVID-19 variants are a variable that still necessitates vigilance.
We are watching carefully for them. Because we have not found them does not mean they are not here. Those variants spread more easily, and depending on the study, anywhere from 30 to 50 to 70% more efficiently, and therefore can spread more quickly. They also have, at least one of them, may have a higher rate of mortality, morbidity, than the current strain. So we're going to be watching that very carefully.
Dr. Romero also stresses that people should continue to get vaccinated for coronavirus because it's the only way to move past the pandemic. The governor says the state can't keep directives with penalties in place forever, but if people's behavior changes as a result of today's announcement and leads to more cases and more hospitalizations, he's prepared to reinstate mandated public health measures. You can watch the governor's full briefing on his YouTube channel.
That's pianist Roberto Magris and bassist Eric Hochberg in the background. And I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz. We'll hear more from these fine musicians, as well as Freddie Hubbard, Charles Lloyd, Ahmed Jamal, and much more. Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. February is Heart Health Month, but consideration regarding the health of our heart, probably a good idea any time of year. Still, we thought it a good time to check in with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences for another conversation about health and aging. We asked Dr. Larry Wright, Associate Program Director of the UAMS Northwest Regional Campus Internal Medicine Residency Program and an Associate Professor of Internal Medicine at UAMS, about what it means to get a diagnosis of heart failure. First up, he says he's not thrilled with that term, heart failure.
I don't think it communicates the condition well, and it causes people to be misled into other assumptions that require some education. Now, if they get that education, maybe it served the good purpose of everybody recognizing we've got to explain this better. Because sometimes in medicine, and with the way our healthcare system is and everything's in a hurry, it seems like nowadays, we sometimes fail to address in the way of explanation some of the most basic things. And if you don't get the basic part, then you're not likely to get the more complicated parts. So in the case of heart failure, it simply means that the heart as a pump is failing to pump strong enough to keep blood pumped forward efficiently into the rest of the body. Therefore, fluid backs up into the lungs, backs up into the liver, backs up into the legs, and so that we see edema. And so that's what heart failure means. So it's failing to pump efficiently enough.
Your description of the heart as a pump, and this is a crude sort of analogy, but, you know, in our cars or our home heaters or whatever, we have pumps, and over time they have been used a lot. Is that something that happens with us as we age, that our heart can begin to, I don't know, I don't want to say wear down, but it can become fatigued?
Absolutely. And there's usually it's usually a result of not just age, but possibly the most common thing is chronic hypertension, elevated blood pressure. But just about as common is underlying coronary artery disease, the kind of heart disease that leads to heart attacks. And it can be, or it can be dysfunctional valves in the heart. And then there's a large group of, it's not the most common diagnosis, but a large group of conditions that fall into the category of what's called a cardiomyopathy, where the heart muscle has gotten so weak for one reason or another that the heart chambers dilate and the heart is very enlarged. So in classic heart failure, among other things that happen, heart itself enlarges. So an enlarged heart is often a weaker heart, a weaker pump.
All right. Let's say you have had a diagnosis in this with this term, heart failure. What are some of the treatments, and it, of course, will depend, I imagine, on the different causes, but what are some of the treatments that are available?
Well, broadly speaking, they fall into two categories. Medications, and we have, fortunately, several categories of medications that are different from each other that can be used in combinations, various recipe combinations, that are very effective in different kinds and different stages of heart failure. So what's happened in the last 20 to 40 years with medications for heart failure is very impressive. Though they have their limits, these medications can so improve the pumping function of the heart and so reduce the fluid backup that I was describing, you know, that's into the lungs, causing shortness of breath, and into the liver and into the kidneys and into the legs, causing the edema we think of. They work so well, but there'll come a time when they're less and less effective. Heart failure has been historically the most common cause of hospitalizations in older adults. Whatever the cause of the heart failure, it's that diagnosis has been. It's gotten a little better in recent years because programs have built up around, treating follow through and prevention and this kind of thing and monitoring more closely. But still, it's about the most common thing to put an older adult in the hospital. And of course, it has a huge impact on quality of life. Mm. You know, the basic symptoms, I might just
sure, please
go over right quickly because a lot of people recognize these, but I can also tie them into why these symptoms reflect heart failure. The most common and famous symptom with heart failure will be shortness of breath. Clearly, it's not the only thing that can make an older adult short of breath. It's just maybe the most important one that you wouldn't want to miss. It's like chest pain. Chest pain that reflects heart attacks or angina that might lead to a heart attack is not anywhere near the most common type of chest pain, but it is the most important because if you miss it, someone may have a heart attack. They may die suddenly because of that heart attack. You never want to miss that. And same thing with shortness of breath. When someone comes in with shortness of breath, and it will primarily be with exertion, but it also will be an inability to lie flat and not be short of breath. So breathe comfortably lying flat. So historically, one of the ways of describing the severity of heart failure would be 1, 2, or 3 pillow orthopnea. Orthopnea being the inability to be comfortable lying flat. So propping one's chest and upper body up on a pillow would be one way to sleep more comfortably. And if it requires 3 pillows, that's much worse heart failure. So so shortness of breath is the most classic symptom. But swelling of the legs, the hooker there is that if you're 40 years old and you have a reason you're going into heart failure, one of the early pitfalls will probably be swelling. And there are some other things that could do it in someone 40 years old, but in older adults, there are many things that could cause swelling of the legs. So, and that are much more common than heart failure. Even. So we just dilated, chronically dilated veins, in the legs, things like that. So it's not all the classical symptoms don't always apply with older adults.
Dr. Larry Wright is Associate Program Director of the UAMS Northwest Regional Campus Internal Medicine Residency Program and an Associate Professor of Internal Medicine at UAMS. He talked to us about heart health as part of our series about health and aging, in conjunction with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences Northwest Regional Campus. This is Ozarks at Large.
Support for KUAF comes from the Walmart Museum on the Square in downtown Bentonville. Scheduled visits are welcomed daily from noon to 6 p.m. WalmartMuseum.com to reserve your visit or for more information.
It is the final Friday of February. With me on the phone from her home office in Bella Vista is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Becca, welcome back. I bet you're like me and you're happy to see February almost in the rearview mirror.
No kidding.
Now, you know, last weekend we had, when we were talking about possible events, we gave the caveat because there was still snow on the ground, it was still going to be cold. Not this weekend.
No, and the best part to me about this weekend, well, there's a couple of wonderful parts. The best part to me is there's live theater at Arkansas Public Theater in Rogers. The premise of the Clean House is that there's a doctor who doesn't want to clean her house because she's a doctor, right?
Right.
So she hires a maid from Brazil to clean her house. Except the maid isn't really a maid. The maid is a comedian, and she doesn't want to clean the house because she's busy trying to think of jokes. Her parents were the funniest people in her village. So instead of her cleaning the house, the doctor's sister comes and cleans the house because she loves creating the order of a clean house. And then in the midst of all of that, the doctor finds out her husband is having an affair with one of his patients. And it's much funnier than that premise sounds. Daniela Kidd, who is playing that role, which is really the lead, Matilda the Portuguese maid, is from Brazil. And she's amazing. So the show opens tonight at 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock tomorrow night, 2 o'clock Sunday, and again March 4th through 7th. Tickets start at $10 for students. You do need to make a reservation because they're limiting size of the audience, social distancing and masks required and all the stuff that we should be about done having to say, right? Because we know that. And if you want to get on a wait list, I don't know if any tickets will come open, but there's four Fort Smith Symphony concerts this weekend. You know, they're doing the abbreviated concerts and doing them twice. So at 5 and 7:30 tomorrow, there's Awesome Classics. And then at 5 and 7:30 on Sunday, they're doing the score and showing the movie Charlie Chaplin's The Kid. If you want to see about a wait list, call 452-7575. And then there's also a show that's happening virtually at the Walton Art Center. I did not see Dixie's Tupperware Party when it was here 2 years ago, but this is the sequel called Dixie's Happy Hour.
Right.
Writer and comedian Chris Anderson, who plays this drag persona of Dixie, and says that this show is about the four basic food groups, rum, gin, vodka, and tequila. Because the premise is every time she makes a cocktail, it reminds her of a story, so she tells all these stories, and it's just fun. And it's a streamed performance, not on demand, because she wants to replicate the idea of going out to the theater.
I love that. I absolutely love that.
This happens this weekend and March 4th through 7th, 8 o'clock Thursday through Saturday, 3 o'clock on Sunday. Streaming from the Walton Art Center, tickets are $35 per household and must be purchased 2 hours prior to showtime. And you can find out more at waltonartcenter.org. And then also online,
The Symphony of Northwest Arkansas recorded a piece of music in the Great Hall at Crystal Bridges that they're debuting right now, and it's both audio and video. You may have never heard of the composer unless you've been around Northwest Arkansas for the last 5 or 6 years. Her name is Florence Price. She was born in 1887 in Little Rock, went off to the New England Conservatory, which was one of the few conservatories that admitted African Americans at the time. But it wasn't until 1931, after she'd moved to Chicago, that she began to write music for the orchestral world. And she told a conductor she faced two challenges. To begin with, I have two handicaps, those of sex and race. I am a woman and I have some Negro blood in my veins. And so this is a piece of music that I don't think's been heard all the way through here. It's her piano quintet in A minor with Tomoko Kashiwagi as the principal pianist. And then I wanted to tell folks about something new we've been doing in the Sunday Profile section in case you haven't seen it. We have a new book column. It was something that people had asked us about, you know, do you review books? Can you review my book? So we decided to take it in kind of a really broad expanse. We call it Hidden Gems. So sometimes it's old books that we're looking at in a new way. We've already interviewed Charlaine Harris, that wrote the True Blood books, and Laurel K. Hamilton, who wrote the Anita Blake vampire killer books. Mm-hmm. But we've also interviewed Zeke Taylor about his new book of memoirs, and Raideen Narine about her new collection of short stories.
Right.
And this Sunday, an author friend of mine from Kansas City named Rob Howell, who writes science fiction, is going to talk about how you become an author.
If you need someone to review Icelandic murder mysteries, I know a guy.
Ooh, I would love that. That sounds like a hidden gem. So there will be interesting things every Sunday, I think.
Excellent. We need more interesting things. We always need more interesting things.
I want to hear about Icelandic murder mysteries when we get off the-
You don't have the time for me to start. But I will tell you that Becca Martin Brown is the features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. She's with us most Fridays. Becca, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was fun.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today we're speaking with Peter Nierengarten. He's environmental director at the City of Fayetteville. Peter, nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Pete. Excited to be here.
Real quickly, environmental director for a city. That sounds like a fun job.
It is. It's a lot of fun. I get to work on a lot of really interesting projects, everything from invasive species to renewable energy to Fayetteville's Cultural Arts Corridor.
And that's what we're talking about today, the Cultural Arts Corridor. Y'all are wanting help from the public to come up with a cool name for this. But first, let's back up for a listener who may not know. What exactly is this?
So the Cultural Arts Corridor is a project in downtown Fayetteville. It was funded by the 2019 bond vote, and it consists of primarily three spaces. One is the Fay Jones Woods across from the Fayetteville Public Library expansion. The other area is the West Avenue Civic Plaza across from the Walmart Center. And the third area is a parking deck to be located on the northwest corner of Dixon and West Avenue. And then it also includes streetscape improvements along West Avenue, connecting all those locations, as well as trail improvements along the Razorback Greenway, connecting all those locations.
Basically, just in a quite large, nice, walkable area in our downtown.
Absolutely. It'll really be an enhancement and improvement to the downtown, creating some pedestrian and people-friendly spaces for folks to occupy and enjoy passive recreation, as well as some programmed activities in the spaces as well in the future.
And Yara wanting help from the community to come up with a cool name for this area. Now, this it ends Sunday night, so just a few more days of this. Tell us what you're looking for.
Yeah, so the name Cultural Arts Corridor has always kind of been a utilitarian name describing what the area is. But what we'd like to help from the public doing is coming up with a name that's much more creative and location specific to Fayetteville and our Ozark region. So we've opened up this naming or renaming opportunity to the public. It started at the beginning of February and runs through midnight on Sunday. And we're asking folks to submit online their idea for a new name for the spaces, and then also a description of why their naming submission is a good choice for these spaces in downtown Fayetteville.
I go back to, I believe it was Her Majesty's Royal Navy a few years back, had a new boat, and they put it out to the public to name it. And the way they did it, though, it was voted on by the public, and I believe the boat became known as Bodie McBoatface. I'm wondering, is this going to be the same type of thing, or are y'all just going to kind of get a group together and pick the one that y'all think is best?
Yeah, so it's a great question. After we get all the naming submissions together, and as part of submitting your name submission, you can also elect to participate in the narrowing of those names. And so after we close submission entries on Sunday night, we'll get this group together. And essentially, they'll operate like a focus group, and they're called the People's Panel. And the People's Panel is going to help us narrow. I think we've got about 250 names so far. Help us narrow that down to a selection of 3 to 4 names that we will put back out to the public for the public to vote on. But the goal is to use that group to prevent something that from being a final selection that, you know, is a little bit silly or ridiculous or maybe isn't just appropriate for Fayetteville. So the goal is to get that final vote back out to the community by mid-March and allow for a final selection of a name for the spaces.
Peter Nierengarten, Environmental Director at the City of Fayetteville. Again, you have an opportunity to help name this cultural arts corridor through this Sunday at midnight. Peter, where should people go to either learn more or give their name?
They can go to FayettevilleCAC.com. That's our website, and learn about the project and submit their name and sign up to be on the People's Panel.
That's FayettevilleCAC.com. Peter Nierengarten with the City of Fayetteville. I bet you we're going to come up with a really cool name that's going to fit this area just perfectly.
That's the plan and the hope. And we really appreciate the public's input and help with this project.
The Community Spotlight and KUAF, Local Matters.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Seligman, Missouri. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Timothy Dennis produced today's show. Contributors included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, and Zuzanna Sitek, who monitored today's announcement by Governor Asa Hutchinson. Also, thanks to Michael Tilley from our partner Talk Business and Politics for his Friday help, and Becca Martin Brown, the features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Daryl Sean is the writer and performer of our theme. That theme is titled First Hurrah. You can find out more about us at OzarksAtLarge.com. You can ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large to hear the most recent edition of our daily show. And we're not just a daily show. We also have a weekend version. You can join us Sunday morning at 9 for Weekend Ozarks at Large right here on 91.3 KUAF. And if you ever miss an edition of our daily show, don't worry. If you subscribe to our free podcast through any of the major podcast distributors, you can listen to us on your schedule. We will be back with a brand new week of daily shows beginning Monday at noon and 7. Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History will be with us to continue our archival series on the integration of Little Rock Central High School. That and much more on Monday's edition of Ozarks at Large. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Be well.